Hello and welcome to recording number 24 of Gary Gygax's Sea of Death, an annotated reading. Today is September 29th, 2021. Last recording, we saw Gord and Lita make it into the temple of the Zul Pygmies in the City Out of Mind. They broke open, Gord, looking for a replacement sword, broke open this glass container with what he thought was holding a statue of an ancient Zul warrior. And instead, it animated the Zul warrior from a millennia in the past or more. Gord was victorious. He got the sword, and then he tried to cut the Theopart free from where it was hanging from the center of the temple. And just as he does so, and the great crystalline sphere that holds the artifact smashes down, Obmi enters, and the sphere rolls over right to Obmi's feet. Lita runs for it, because she's going to need to get her invisibility ring on. And then a Gord, a Bolt, the wizard who is accompanying Obmi, sends a lightning bolt toward Gord, and we don't know what happened. Everything drops off from there, and we go to the next chapter, and that is where we are going to begin today, if I can get my place here, is on page number 278. It's the beginning of chapter 18, and we're starting at the first paragraph. The voices came from far, far away. By listening intently, he could just make out what they were saying. Are you sure that is the right container? Yes, be careful there. I think this is a waste of our precious. Do your work and keep silent. Our lives might depend on this. And there was a tingling all over the universe. The night sky changed. It had been lightless. No moons, no stars. A glow appeared, and then the whole canopy of darkness was suddenly peppered with tiny points of light. These motes twinkled, grew brighter, and then began to blaze and dance. Soon the velvety black sky was a mass of whizzing comets and little suns that seemed to spark and dance as the cosmos grew brighter and stranger with each passing moment. But as the comets streaked here and there and the stars became larger and brighter, the tingling changed to sharp pain and the whole universe shuddered. That's done it. Ready with the drop there. Must we add elixir to balm? It seems we expend the whole. There would be no whole without this part. Gord opened his eyes. He hurt all over, but the pain was fading, even as it forced him into consciousness. Several faces swam into shape in the distance as he forced his eyes to focus. As his vision cleared, one of the faces came nearer and spoke to him. Drink this now carefully. You mustn't spill a drop. He was thirsty, parched in fact, and did not need to be told twice. One hand supported the back of his head, while another raised the cup to his lips. The liquid had a slightly effervescent quality, and it was sweet-tasting and felt soothing to his mouth, throat, and stomach as he drank. Gord was willing to drain every drop. No need to caution him about that. It was very tempting to try and gulp the stuff, but the young man repressed the urge and quaffed it slowly, allowing only a trickle at a time to pass his lips, wash over his tongue, and go down his gullet. He sighed with regret as the last drop was consumed. His outside still hurt, but his insides felt better than he could ever recall. The hand propping up his head lowered it gently back down to a pillow of rolled-up cloth. Can you speak? It was the voice of the nearest face again. Gord blinked his eyes and thought about that for a minute. glow inside him was fading, moving outward. As it did so, the hurt that had pervaded him changed and shrank, squeezed out of existence between the cool tingling coming from the surface of his body and the wonderful warmth radiating out from his core. "Yes, and I can sit up too," he finally replied. Before anyone could speak or act, the young man pulled himself into a sitting position. The brisk movement made his head swim a bit, but he felt no more pain. "What is this?" he blurted out as he looked down at himself. Bard was stark naked, and his skin was bright pink. "We found you near death," a thin man with corded muscles and stubbled cheeks said. "I was not for it," the fellow explained, "but Smoker and the others insisted." "That post is trying to tell you, stranger, is that we used healing balm and an elixir of much potency to bring you back from the gate of death," one called Smoker added. Ward was impressed and grateful, but being alive was not the most important thing on his mind right now. "But I have a shirt and hose, even a tunic or robe. I have many more questions, but I prefer to converse in a more dignified condition." Ward was neither shy nor prudish, but when all the others around him were clothed, the young thief saw nakedness as an extreme disadvantage. He quickly surveyed the room. He was still in the temple, but the place was a total shambles. Walls and floors were scarred and broken. Dead bodies were scattered around the chamber. Three male drow, two men in nomad garb, and one corpse dressed in the robes of a spell worker. All right, break. See, here's a comment about how a statement from Lita about us, and how much she hated that pig. She's thinking, I guess, you know, with Lita, a lot of her personality is Eclavdra's. I mean, she really is only a few months old. And after, Vuron, obviously, she's a particularly strange kind of clone, because she should be just a duplicate of Eclavdra. So some of this stuff, of course, is how much she hates us when she's never met us. Is coming, you know, straight from Eclavdra's memories. We know that us, as Chris says, humiliated Eclavdra back when she was Gratz'd ambassador, back in Artifact of Evil, and she's never forgiven him for that. We are kind of left off. We've got the end of a battle right here. And we see three male dead drow. Now, those sound like the ones that were accompanying the real Eclavdra. And the two nomads that were going to be sent off last chapter after Lita. We also have Gord now surrounded by some strange characters, but obviously like human-sized. It sounds as if Gord has been stripped of all of his possessions, maybe by these people or maybe by Abmi or Eclavdra, but there seems to be a kind of fight going on in the temple now that it's all broken up, and it's a place that would have been well worth looting with all those display cases of various artifacts from the Sul Imperium, as we saw with the ancient warrior and his powerful armor and shield. Of course, he was still alive to use them. And it'd be interesting, it's coming here, if Eclavdra manipulates others with her charms. I would guess, Lita and Eclavdra are at the very least twins in physical appearance. And she is supposed to be ravishing. So Yclavdra is supposed to be beautiful, as is the human forms of Yggdrasil and Zuchtmoy. And even though those may be, you know, forms they've chosen, it's rather like these are, you know, like the most, some of the most beautiful women you'd ever see. So especially, you know, like with Yclavdra and the various drow, although I don't know, you know, at this point, Yclavdra never really seems to be trying to wheedle anything out of anybody except Gratzt. And I'm sure she is using her charms on Gratzt. I think it's interesting that they take on these forms of human beauty when we also see them, and Yclavdra herself, having rather disgusting appeal to rather things that would be disgusting to us, like when she's consuming that spider back in the underground area of Uz's, under his throne room, where he has that underground area where it's Zuchtmoy's fungus. Lita, it's commented Lita here is one of the most interesting characters so far. And she definitely is. She's, you know, I think it's because he's definitely trying to make her a little fuller character. And rather than having her somebody like Evely, who was there, you know, was again a kind of cookie cutter version of a, of a captured princess in a way. And Lita's proven, Lita's proven to be a very interesting character, as is Vuron. You know, Vuron, who is unlike any other of the demons that you're going to encounter. And I doubt very much that any of Yclavdra's charms would work on Vuron. He seems to have no interests except, these various, maybe curiosity and ambition of a sort. The strangest thing, of course, about Vuron is that he appears to be lawful among very chaotic surroundings. All right. I am going to restart. It is page 280 and the third paragraph down. After a moment, someone had stripped one of the dead nomads and tossed a burnoise of Yolai sort to him. It was only slightly torn, and he put it on without hesitation, despite its pungent odor. "I thank you," he said, meaning it sincerely. "Now what the dancing devils happened to me?" "Dojar here, the one named Smoker, spoke up. Thinks you were hit by a bolt of lightning. That dead spellbinder over there was tossing all sorts of them around." Gord looked at Dojar, a small brown-skinned fellow with blue-black hair and very white teeth, that he showed as he smiled at the young adventurer. "I was studying magic, stranger, when the death pygmies took me as a slave," he said. "I was young then. Had I only studied harder, perhaps I could have taught those little blasters a lesson or two." The brown man didn't look very old now, scarcely into adulthood, except that his body was worn and his eyes looked very old and very hard. "So that's why I'm so pink. It healed my burns." "That is right, Zehab," Dojar chimed in again. "He found a small store of medicine in the barracks of the pygmy chiefs and kept it with us for any great emergency. I thought you needed such help if you were to survive." "Why did you bother with me? Your revolt appears to have succeeded. You, all of you, should be getting clear of this miniature version of the Hells as quickly as you can. I don't want to see my work go to waste, after all." He finished with a thin smile. Smoker looked hard at Post. "Didn't I tell you? He is the one." Then turning to Gord, the big scar-faced man related more of his tale. "I was with the group that you and that drow female freed, stranger. How you managed to get to this city and to bring those others from the outside to join in the attack is a miracle. I'm grateful, and all the rest of us are too. We want you to be our leader as we fight our way out. Instead of acknowledging the request, Cord sought more information. Where are the others? The ones who began attacking when you men were freeing yourself and finding weapons. Smoker turned to a thin ex-slave with a telltale signs of mixed elvish and human blood. Pointed ears, slight stature, fine features with slanting eyes, hair and flawless complexion. Jade, you know that answer best. Tell him. Break. So here, I like it. Here is Gygax's description of a half-elf. And I don't quite remember one being exactly like this. But this is very spot on. And so you get, right here, I think it's worth noting, is, the pointed ears, slight stature. That is, a very nice description that could be used. When you want to describe half-elves in your campaign. All right, I'm going to restart page 281 and the final paragraph. A half-elf brushed back his long black hair from his forehead. I didn't see it all, but Mullen and Cockabor did. They'd both caught it, or I'd have them speak, too. Anyway, stranger, we'd all have been in it deep, except for the others who were fighting the pygmy folk. We only had to contend with their baboons, mostly, and a few squads of their warriors. Most of the little white vermin were busy trying to stop the dwarf and his bunch coming at them from the north, and that little group of drow sliding up from the opposite direction. That took all of their spellcasters away, mostly. You know, the young man nodded, still not sure what had happened in this place. Call me Gord, or Farzeal, as the nomads have taken to naming me, if you like. It doesn't matter to me either way. What I need to know, though, is what happened to the others when they got to the temple here, especially the drow female and the thing that was in the crystalline sphere. Sure thing, Gord, that's a good name, Shade continued. There were groups of escapers all over the center of the city. Most of them sticking to the areas around the red lights so the men could see to fight. Anyway, Mullen said that he and a group of 3 or 4 dozen were arming themselves from an arsenal the pygmies kept when the dwarf and his henchmen came on the scene. They had a spellcaster with them who was tossing magic left and right while the dwarf was cleaning up on those little white midgets like a fox goes after chickens. What other things did this Mullen tell you? Gord prompted. That's about it, Shade replied, brushing away his long bangs again. When the dwarf kept moving, he and his company followed, taking advantage of the confusion to wipe up pygmies. I met Mullen near here, and that's when he told me what he'd seen. What about the drow? Gord asked. That wasn't Mullen, that came from Cocklebur. He was from the other side of the crystal mists, you know. Some sort of Grugok. Pure-blooded, he was. The sight of dark elves made him mad. He didn't know that a drow actually helped to set us all free. He and a handful of others thought these birds were fair game and wanted to go after them instead of the pygmy bastards. Then they saw that the drow were really giving it to the little albinos, knocking the blasters off with all sorts of magic. Those nasty little crossbows of theirs, too. You know, the ones which are small enough to hold in your hand and... Yes, Shade, but what happened? Sorry, Gord. Cocklebor and his friends gathered up a company along the way, just like we were all doing. They stripped dead pygmies and found arms wherever they could, all the while trailing the drow. Our group got here from another direction, coming up behind the dwarf with Mullen's group. We figured him for an ally and wanted to join up with him, so we waited for him and his spell worker to come out. That's when I met Cocklebur, and he told us about the Dark Elves. Then we figured we'd have lots of help when the dwarf and the drow came out. Problem was, the damned albinos decided to rally here, right outside this temple. We got in big trouble, because all of those little bastards tried to kill us to get at who was inside. Before it was over, the runts managed to get most of us. That's when Cocklebur and Mullen went down. But we got most of them at the same time, and the others scattered. Then I heard a big commotion inside here, so I took a few of the boys and came in to see what was going on. It was one hell of a sight, let me tell you. At last this garrulous fellow was going to get to the point. What was going on? Gord asked impatiently, tempted to grab Shade and give him a shake to make the half-elf speak more quickly. While the dwarf was about to toss his hammer at the ball of glass, or whatever it was that was sitting on the floor, we'd just come in, and he and the rest didn't even notice us. But we saw plenty. I guess he'd already thrown it once. That was the noise I heard from outside. Because this time he hollered, "It will not withstand another blow," just before he let the thing go. The hammer hit the globe, and the thing rang, making a big sound like just like earlier. But it didn't break, and the hammer came flying right back to him. The dwarf's magic worker tried to say something, but the dwarf was cursing a streak, and I never heard so many demons' names as that one knew. That's when all of us got into the best cover we could find. Then Big Shoulder shoved the mage off, and he really chucked the hammer this time, and it banged into the globe. The damn thing flew into fragments and bits of steel buzzed in all directions. I'll tell you, the globe broke into pieces at the same time, exploding with a bang. Could be that was what busted the hammer. I saw pieces of chains go sailing off in all directions. The glass stuff just sort of disintegrated after it broke. And then I got a glimpse of this thing on the floor, a cone-shaped black thing, sitting right where the glass ball had been. All right, break. So, Obmi loses his hammer right here, and destroys that, you know, that material. And Chris has put up the Grugok elf here. It's from Dragon 67. I forgot what the Grugok wild elves akin to Sylvan, but smaller, thinner, and very fair. Now, as I remember, the Grugok were the original Valley Elves, and then they started to be calling Valley Elves in a kind of ridiculous way. But I like the picture that they have here. If you from Dragon 67. Of the Grugok elf mounted on a
looks like an elk or a caribou or something.
Yeah, something like that.
I think they could live in the Valley of the Mage, but
yeah, I'm not sure if they were supposed to be, you know, what they from the original folio box set, whether it was something like these Grugok rather than that Valley Elf name.
Yeah, I'm not sure either.
Yeah. So, I'm Gygax. This is more about the story. So far, I've really, really like what he's doing with the recap. I'd love to. You know, it's really a stirring thing of what you can do if you're planning an adventure here, and that freeing of the slaves, and then the kind of pitched battles that are going on between the freed slaves, and then how they're following up on both Obmi and Ecladra's as they're sweeping in. Because now, like they said, they're the ones who are mostly running into the baboon-like things. And as we remember, those creatures are not, they would not be super high level. They'd definitely be the foot soldiers. And Gord had been going through them pretty quickly back in the treasure room beneath that temple they had originally entered in. And so here, the slaves of various sorts, because you don't know, like if you think about like back in the G series, the prisoners were decently, they were, I think, like supposed to be 7th or 8th level prisoners, so that you could easily have them as henchmen or even replacements to slain characters, which is what happened to us back when we originally ran G1. So if you're thinking of running a City Out of Mind campaign, and, you know, again, it could be something where you don't cross the desert, you could come up through the Underdark, because they obviously have that connection. And then they also, you know, they have some way out of the Sea of Dust through their tunnels and such. There's a comment here, one of the albinos are the same thing as the Lirara, the Sul who were trapped in Slorotan's tunnels. And that could be, or an offshoot of them, or the baboon-like things, they could be, you know, the Lirara, and these, the more advanced pygmy Sul could be from the city. It's very, you know, it's hard to, it's really nothing's defined, so you can just choose, or they could have split the same way, where some of them became, yeah, that they're the results of a similar process. Now, I will say that I think that everything to do with them being, you know, that these pygmy Sul and the baboon-like things are a result of the magical ash from the Rain of Colorless Fire, because it is a mutator. It is mutating plants and animals, and certainly would mutate the surviving Sul as well. All right. So I'm out of this, though I'm also impressed that Abmi has smashed that hammer of his. And we know that the stuff that's strong enough to encase the third artifact, it's surprising, but that Abmi has managed to destroy very powerful, you know, that returning hammer.
And yeah, that's his signature weapon.
Yes, and for good reason, because it's a ranged melee weapon of extreme power, and if it manages to return, it's either you know, it's either a thing where you can fight and then catch, and then, you know, throw it and then catch it the next.
Yeah, like the boomerang.
Yeah, and it would allow say Ami is high level and he gets say 3 per 2, you know, like 3 attacks every 2 turns, or even 2 attacks a turn, and he could throw that every single combat turn, because he could throw it and then catch it and then throw it the next turn, and that would just be, you know, tremendous. Because one of the problems you run into with your fighters is that switching from a ranged to melee weapon, and that normally their ranged weapons are, you know, rather pitiful compared to what their melee weapon's going to be. So that returning hammer was, it would have been a very powerful thing in the game. All right. I am going to restart. It is page 284 in the third paragraph, down from the top. The dwarf was dancing up and down. I think he was madder than a wet fire elemental about losing the hammer, and pleased to have shattered the sphere all at the same time. Before you could tell for sure, though, and before he or any of his pals made a move for where the black cone lay, 3 male drow appeared in the room as if by magic, and magic they began tossing. The guy with the dwarf was no slouch at the game either. He sent some vicious stuff, and took a lot in the process. The dwarf cleared out of the line of casting between the dark elves and his henchmen. I'll bet he wanted that throwing hammer then. A whole storm of stuff came out of those spellbinders, and then it went as black as pitch in the temple. Even I was blind. Like, I really like that, madder than a wet fire elemental. I'm going to have to remember that one. Obviously these are Ecclavdra's three male drow, and no sign of her yet. All right. I'm going to restart. It's page 284, second paragraph from the end. It's plenty bright in here now, Gord said. How did the light return? Shade bit his lip, pondering that. I just don't know. He started crawling up toward the center when there was no more noise, only the pitch dark. Then these gold light globes started to appear, almost like fireflies at first, real dim and faint. And then they popped back to full brightness, and I had to blink a couple times to be able to see. I think I saw one drow standing off alone over that way, the half-elf told Gord, pointing to way the young thief had first come into the temple with Lita, and there were two others still in the room, a male and a female. The male was carrying a sack with something in it, and the black cone wasn't on the floor where it used to be anymore. These two black elves were moving pretty quick already, but when the lights came full on, they took off together as fast as they could run. There were three dead drow in the room, the ones over there. The human spellbinder was a goner, too. The dwarf was on his feet, but didn't seem to know where he was for a minute. Then, when he spotted the dark elves running away, he let out a bellow that made my ears hurt. There were a couple of his nomad warriors nearby. I know because they came out from hiding at Big Shoulder's roar and tried to catch up with their master. The dwarf had wings on his heels, magic boots for sure, Gord. He ran after the drow like a courser in full charge. This awful-looking weapon held over his head with one hand, and the two men dressed in Yoli garments were left way behind. That was a good thing for them, too. I peeked around to see what was going to happen, and just as the dwarf gets to the doorway over there that the dark elves ran through, I heard a pop and a fizzing sound. From where I was, I could see only partly because the dwarf was between me and whatever it was. I saw a little of it, too, the one named Edge interjected. Shade's getting around to saying something appeared in the air. That's so, the half-elf affirmed. I've never seen black fire before, and I don't hope to ever again. But suddenly appeared with a pop, burned with a fizzing sound, looked like black fire, run so as to create some sort of awful sign. The instant it started, the dwarf dropped his weapon and began howling and beating himself as if he were on fire. I thought he'd gone crazy because of the thing. Then I see that the fellow's beard is on fire. Real flames, though not the black stuff. Big Shoulders was in real trouble because he couldn't seem to put out the flames. All he could do was howl and whack himself uselessly. Then the pair of nomads saved his ass. One knocked the dwarf down. The other flung something over him. Both had their backs to the black fire, and as soon as the dwarf went down, I was careful not to look at it. When I did look again, one was carrying the awful weapon, and the other was dragging the dwarf away, still not looking back, of course. We let them clear out, and then we came out from hiding and discovered you, Shade finished. Thanks, Gord said with a heavy sigh. Then he remembered something he wanted very much to check on. Did you see the one drow, the lone one, I mean, after that? No.
All right, I'm going to break. There's a comment here. Obmi has to deal with a few things, has to deal with things with fewer options. All right. It's not enough. So Obmi really, Obmi's always had, remember, he always kept Keek with him. And then another spellcaster. Obmi always seems to like to have some kind of spellcaster with him as a partner. And, you know, he Bolt, obviously not some ninth level magician. It's because we were commenting early on where Bolt and the previous spellcaster were called a warlock and a sorcerer. And it was pointed out that those were actually level names for level 8 and 9 in AD&D. But I don't think Obmi, Gord, and such, if we're even using AD&D anymore in these new Infinities books, they've got to be 12th, 13th, 14th level, maybe even a little higher. And I don't think anyone who's going to be there to serve Obmi is going to be that level. So I'm really thinking Bolt again is probably 12th or 13th level, a very, very powerful magic user. And obviously the way that he was throwing around magic. Now, he might also have had wands and rings and maybe necklaces and stuff that he could use to toss lightning and throw fireballs and such. But at the same time, he seems to have been a very powerful magic user. And, you know, one of the things with Obmi is that weapon, that hammer has been his little cherished item since we've seen him. And a very, very overpowered, powerful weapon it was. So with that gone, he's down to his melee weapon, which, of course, is that Martell, gifted him by Gratston Vuron. Gifted him by, now it would be Zuckmoy, I guess. I forgot, or was it Yggdrasil who gifted him that Martell? So, yeah. And, you know, and the favor of Zuckmoy. Now, with this, I don't think he can call upon Zuckmoy as part of this ridiculous contest that he's in with Eclavdra. All right. I'm going to restart. Page 286, and it is the fourth paragraph from the top. "I've got the picture of what happened," Gord said, turning to the one called Smoker. "Now, what is it you want me to do? You can see in the dark better than any of us, we know, because some of us have seen you in operation. We have scouts out now, rounding up everyone else we can find who has escaped. We are hereby appointed our captain," Post added, with a tinge of challenge in his tone. "You lead the way, and the whole lot of us will follow, until we get above." Gord wasn't sure he wanted to be saddled with the responsibility. After all, he had a dwarf and a couple of drows to chase down. However, his chances of getting out were better if he had a group around him. "What if I refused?" he asked in a casual tone. "That's what I thought you'd do," Post said grimly, "and that's why I was against wasting our medicines on you. Speaking for me, I'd say we should kill you for refusing. That's up to Smoker, Edge, and Shade." Not waiting to hear what those worthies had to say, Gord decided to take initiative in the matter. "Well, I hate to disappoint you, Post, but I do not refuse. Let's just say that I wanted to know who was fully behind me and who might be slow to assist." The others laughed at that, and the lean man glowered. Gord had settled the matter to the apparent satisfaction of everyone, but made an enemy in the process. "What are your orders, Captain?" a burly man asked, a huge grin splitting his ugly but honest face. "I'm called Barrel. We're all willing and able to do as you say, only get us out. First, I'll need my weapons and my armor. Where are my dagger and sword and my mail shirt?" Post grumbled for a second, then produced the dagger in its sheath. The sleeve slightly burn damage, but intact. A little episode explained a lot, thought Gord. Then someone called Grubstepper handed forth the sword, saying honestly that he did not know Gord had possessed it. The young thief forgave the man, since Gord had not been wearing the weapon when he climbed the chain. Someone else produced the elfin mail from just a few paces away, where it lay on the floor. It had simply been removed so that Gord's body could be covered with the healing balm. Now the young thief took charge, and giving orders seemed to come naturally to him. All right, break. So, Gord's getting back his weapons. But what I wanted to point out was, again, like Gord's nice description of how the healing balm affected him. Now, the balm and also the potions, and how they had to strip him down to get the balm on, which could be an amusing incident in a game. But also, one of the things is that, you don't want to overdo it, but if you are having people stunned, if you're having players who need to take healing potions, I always like to, to say, oh, it, the golden glow or how it tastes. And usually healing potions taste very good, but they could taste very bad. The balm could produce like a cooling effect, or it could be something that was hot on you or got hotter and hotter till you healed. So I would definitely make sure that you're doing like Gygax is doing, and to describe, what effects are of these various potions, just to, spice your game up. All right. I am going to restart this page number 287. And it is the last paragraph. One of you go to that body over there. Man in old-fashioned armor, he said. You'll find he wears the belt and scabbard for this sword. I want both. Smoker or anyone else, get some runners out and spread the word. We move out in half an hour and not a second longer. The albino seemed to be in shock at the moment. There must be plenty of them left. Maybe they've lost their sacred relic, but they'll surely want their slaves back. Or at least revenge upon them. Once they gather their senses and regain courage, all of us are goners unless we move quickly. I'll tell them a quarter hour, Gord, Smoker said. Then he passed instructions to a trio of rugged-looking escapees, and all four ran out. Get ready, men, Gord said to those who remained inside the chamber. Scavenge what you can from these corpses, but don't burden yourselves with treasure. By all means, stay away from the bodies that are standing. While the rest were occupied, Gord went to search the wing where Shade had said he'd seen the lone drow. If the half-elf was right, it could only have been Lita. He went to the vestibule and called her name softly once, and tried the same with more volume. No reply. There was no trace of her in either of the side passages or the rooms beyond. Orders and vestries for senior clergy and acolytes, from all appearances. Then, just as he was about to think the worst, he noticed a bundle in the corner by the door leading to the street. It turned out to be the short black cloak that Lita had been wearing under her Yoli robe, and in the pocket sewn into the lower edge of the garment, the wand she had taken from the pygmy spellcaster. Lita had deserted him, but not without reason. Gord could hardly blame her for trying to get away when they were taken by surprise. After all, as she had once said to him, her mission was more important than either of their lives. Gord assumed that she had fled in order to be able to take up the chase after Obmi and Eclavdra later, and he saw the thing left behind for him in case he also managed to escape somehow. After replacing the wand and donning the cloak, Gord strode back to the central chamber. He spent the next few minutes searching for more suitable garments and a case to protect the wand. He found both in a small side room, its contents apparently left over from when human-sized residents inhabited this city. As he returned to the central chamber, Little Brown Dozier came smiling up to him. "Gord, Zehab, Smoker says that all is in readiness. Those that are able are gathered outside. You're to come now, please, and take charge." That was it. No direction, no plan. He was to go out of the ancient building, take charge, and find a short way out of the maze of this subterranean city just like that. The whole affair was crazy, but even as he thought that, Gord had to grin a little, and he still hoped to somehow catch up with whomever possessed the final key before it was too late. Of course he did. What these ex-slaves expected of him was no more daft than what he expected of himself. "Tell Smoker and the rest that I will be with them in a moment, Dozier," said Gord, a smile still crossing his face. "Are they all well armed?" "Oh, most assuredly, Zehab." The dark brown fellow raised his right arm, holding aloft one of the pygmy's small arbalests that shot a half dozen bolts before having to be reloaded. "And we have swords and spears and glaives, too. Each of us has a weapon or two." All right, break. So I just break here because we've been talking about the various things. Now, I didn't, the drow males had the typical drow hand crossbows, but really no need to bring them up. But these smaller bows possessed by the halfling-sized pygmy Sul, they are poisoned bolts, repeating crossbows that have six shots in them. So, you know, that is a nice little weapon to have there. Of course, those of you fooling with alignments have to watch out for the poison. And, you know, they're small crossbows. I can't imagine what damage they do without the poisoning. It's definitely enough to kill one of the pygmies, as it killed the one back in the treasure room who was wearing the Ring of Invisibility, who got in the way of his own people firing at Gord. So we have a poisoned repeating bolt thrower and crossbow. All right. Now I'm going to restart. It is page number 289. It is the third paragraph from the end. Gord nodded, dismissing Dozier, and then returned to the one man in the whole group that he was least sure of. "Host, get everyone in this place together now. You and this bunch will be with me, understood?" He had a black look on his face, but Post didn't argue. In a moment or two, he had rounded up a score of others. "Let's go, then," Post said as he reported back, standing defiantly before the young thief. Gord ignored the affront and the one who delivered it, instead addressing the assemblage. "Boys, I'm happy to see that none of you broke the other cases, ones with the lifelike statues inside of them." "Not likely," Captain Barrel shouted back. "Look at the guy whose sword you got was enough. Those things come alive, don't they?" "I bet your ass they do, Barrel," Gord called back with a laugh. "And that was good reasoning, too, by the way. You and any of your mates who you know to have thought the same thing are hereby promoted. Barrel, you're my sergeant, and it's up to you to say who are to be corporals. A half dozen is fine." The burly man began his selections, and Gord turned back to the truculent Post. "You," he told the lean man, "are to be at my side every moment. And there's something that needs doing, you'll be the one who gets the job if I say so. Clear?" The man nodded, a little less cocky now. "That's fine. Now get some help and see if you can pry loose a half dozen of those globes," Gord ordered, pointing to the golden spheres that were each only as large as a small melon, but shed sufficient light to make a big room as bright as day. Post walked away to speak with two others, even offering a half-hearted salute before he turned. Lord noticed but did not return the gesture, for he was already busy considering the next step in his plan. "Carol," he hollered at his sergeant approached, "find leather or cloth bags, heavy ones for those lights Post is getting for us. If you can't find bags, gather dark cloth to wrap them in." "Sure thing, Captain Gord," Barrel called back. Behind him, men were already gathering in. Was covered to you. "And here he comes." The lean fellow had two of the shining spheres. Freeing them from the mesh of wire that held them was evidently not harmful to their power, and Gord saw that they could be grasped without discomfort. Those two assistants each brought a pair as well. Gord directed the three over to the waiting sergeant. "Now we go," he told the group, after the globes had been contained and covered. Gord led them outside to where a crowd was gathered. A rapid scan indicated about 60 men and a handful of women. He quickly noted a couple of gnomes and a dwarf. "Sergeant," he said loudly enough for all the men to hear, "hand three of the globes to that dwarf and those two gnomes over there. I'll need some volunteers to carry the other three," he said to the crowd as he looked from face to face in the reddish dimness. "These bundles contain the golden lights from inside the temple," he explained. "Those carrying them will be in the front and at the rear and on each flank. If we're attacked, they'll move away and uncover them. Then the humans here will be able to see and fight. The hateful pygmies will be hindered at the same time, since they cannot stand bright light." "Good enough," Smoker affirmed. "This is our leader, and I say he's the best we've got. Just in any case anyone has his doubts. His name's Gord. Only the lot of you will call him Captain. He'll get us to the surface. Then everyone's on their own." "Smoker said it," Gord told the throng. "I'm Captain, and Smoker and his mates, Edge and Shade, are Lieutenant. Crozier, I'm making you a Sergeant, just the same as Barrel there is." "Agreed. Very good, Captain Gord," Zehab. "Smoker, you three lieutenants have to decide on other corporals. Barrel will tell you who is his choices. About six, I think. I want to divide this bunch up into fighting groups before we set out. One corporal to a group, and each squad no bigger than 10, no smaller than 5. Let the men decide who is in each squad. The ones with the globes are not in any unit. They operate alone, so they can move when needed." "What about the ones who can see well in this gloom?" Smoker asked. "Divide them between the squads," Gord said. "So there's at least one of us in the lead with me, one back in the rear, and the rest spread out along the flanks, I'd say. Are there enough?" The newly made lieutenant scratched his mat of hair. "We got Shade for sure, and maybe another 7 or 8, although it won't surprise me a bit if some of others of Elvish sort happen to join up along the way. Some of them we approached didn't like our chances, you might say, but when they see you leading, that'll change." "Bull," Gord mumbled wryly, pleased at what the man said. "Organize on the march, Smoker. I was the one whining about time, and I've been dithering around ever since. There's enough of the reddish lights on our line of march for everyone to manage for the time being. Let's get on with it." After making certain that Post was right behind him, Gord walked quickly to get a position ahead of the others. He was headed down the avenue the drow had taken in getting to the temple, figuring that where the dark elves had entered, they could leave this little cyst-like nest of albino cannibals in sunless horror. He thought it should be a fairly simple matter to trace the path the invaders followed, for there would be signs of fighting along most of the route. The young man went slowly, missile-shooting wand in hand. After Gord had traveled away from the temple for 5 minutes, he He told Post to locate a lieutenant and find out if everyone was now formed in a fighting team. In a bit, the lean man returned. All was according to Gord's wishes. So far, they had encountered no opposition or seen any of the little albinos other than the dead bodies of those slain by the drow advance. The company was passing through a large plaza littered with pale corpses, and the first attack came. It turned out that not all of the bodies scattered about were dead ones, and for that Gord had to give the runts credit for being clever. Almost a dozen of the ex-slaves fell after the initial discharge of the pygmies' crossbows, poison bolts giving any normal man hit virtually no chance of surviving. Revolutionaries were tough and determined, however. As soon as the attack was apparent, everyone dropped prone. Those able to find a target shot back using the albino's own weapons and poison to retaliate, and golden light sprang up on both flanks and ahead. There were shrill screams at that, for as Gord had said, the little man couldn't abide such illumination so suddenly. All right, break. We're getting close to the end. I wanted to mention that here we have that the poison on the little pygmy's hand crossbows is enough to kill, you know, a normal person. So a low-level character isn't likely to survive a shot from one of these poison crossbow bolts. Very effective then for, you know, those albino drow. You know, those little crossbows then are going to be, you know, very effective against normal troops. So, you know, once again, these Sewell, they are not, they don't seem to be super high level, I guess, but they're not, you know, they're not weak or anything. So, as fighters and, you know, especially as magic users, they're going to be, you know, a deadly encounter, probably, you know, like, getting past mid-level and just at the beginning of high level, you might say. So I'd say, like, if you bring, you know, 8th, 9th, 10th level characters from AD&D, that is, you'd probably be, you know, be coming up against quite a fight against these little pygmies. And especially because there's so many of them. Now, you don't have to be fighting them in the city out of mind. You could be discovering them in the Underdark, and you could also be exploring one of the ruins. How that would make the most sense is, you know, that this quest, a big quest to the city out of mind makes sense, because you're most likely to find the greatest, you know, there may be lost artifacts of the soul of sorts, or just powerful items, or maybe texts on magic use and such that you might find there. Any of the surviving ruins had to have been protected by some kind of power. The rain of colorless fire melted the mountains down, melted the hills down, burnt the rock. So any building that would have been unprotected, it wouldn't just be like wooden and, you know, wood and such. Even stone buildings should have been slagged after the Reign of Colorless Fire. So in a sense, it's kind of like the Sewell Imperium was nuked, you know. And definitely, there are spots. There's spots on Darlene's maps. There's a third that Gord runs into. But any of those should have been a place of clerical or wizardly power, and powerful enough to have withstood the Reign of Colorless Fire. So that was the, you know, the essence of the Sewells, that they were such powerful magic users. All right, it's 6:59, so I think I'm going to end it up here. And let me just bring in Craig. And we'll end it for today.